Really weird stuff.
Really Weird Stuff is a holistic Twin Peaks podcast. That means we discuss each episode within the context of the series as a whole. In other words, spoilers abound. Welcome to Really Weird Stuff, episode 27, wherein we will discuss Twin Peaks, season 2, episode 19.
Yeah, variations on relations.
Written by Harley Payton and Mark Frost, and directed by Jonathan Sanger, his one and only Twin Peaks episode.
Oh.
This episode originally aired April 11th, 1991. I'm Jessica Baxter.
I'm Annie Malone.
And this is kind of an underappreciated episode, I feel like, because it's overshadowed by the three exciting episodes that come after it, but it's not too shabby.
It's pretty funny. Yeah. It has a lot of humor in it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was, like, not looking forward to doing this one. I'm like, oh,
it's actually pretty good. There's no James, there's no shitty plots. Even
right,
though,
yeah, all the dumb plots are kind of dumb. I mean, I don't like Lana, but most of the dumb stuff is out.
Yeah. I mean, Dick Tremaine is always a little annoying, but it's nice when he's just straight up being made a fool by everyone around him, including Lucy and Andy.
Right.
So that's kind of nice. Jonathan Sanger is better known as a producer. He's produced such films as Vanilla Sky, Flight of the Navigator, and a little movie called The Elephant Man.
Oh. And, well, there you go.
Yeah.
So that's the connection.
That's
now
the
I got
connect.
It. Now I got it.
And he would later direct an episode of the Lynch Frost short-lived series On the Air.
Oh, we should watch that sometime.
We really should. Definitely want to keep going with this after we've done all the episodes. And there's so many tangential Lynchian things we can cover. So that seems like a good one. Maybe select episodes of that or just talk about the whole deal.
Yeah, we'll watch it.
I kind of want to do Sunset Boulevard right when we're done. Maybe Fire Walk With Me and then Sunset Boulevard or something like that.
Yeah,
but
for sure.
You guys are recording, but you're not.
We are recording.
You are recording?
Yes.
Yeah.
This is it.
This is
all good stuff.
Wow.
Freaking guest Chris Brugas just audio bombing us, I guess. He lives here too.
This is it.
You guys can't be recording. You sound terrible. We're a little out of practice, but we will get back into it, I think.
I can't remember the last time we did RWS.
It was some time ago. This is the first episode that Mark Frost co-wrote since Leland shuffled off to Buffalo.
Wow.
And the other notable thing about this episode is that right after it aired originally, the series was officially canceled.
Ugh, rude.
ABC would allow the next episode to air in April as scheduled, but then they pushed the last two episodes out into May.
I remember it back in the day. It was so annoying.
No, wait. To summer, after May sweeps.
I remember my brother and I were like, are we the only ones who watch the show?
It had fallen off significantly, but I mean, you're Twin Peaks fans, as David Lynch would say. Greatest fans in the world.
I'm sure.
If you're wondering why there's all these new sort of plots that they're bringing up, it's because they were planning for the next season. They were going to do something with the Donna paternal plotline and the John Justice Wheeler and Audrey thing.
Aww.
They would have revisited that. Which is, I feel like that means that it was mysterious, did she die in the bomb or not? But they were planning on having her not be dead in the bomb, which is nice. We'll never see those two together again. Anyway, this episode is best known, I guess, as the one with the wine taste. Windermere finally revealing his plot, sort of. And Gordon Cole telling Bobby to take another look, Sonny!
Yeah.
So great. A lot of connective tissue setting up the rest of the season.
Yeah.
Why do we think it's called Variations on Relations?
I don't know. Well, I mean, Donna's thing, I guess. Variations on Relations. I don't know who came up with the title.
Some German.
Yeah.
Yeah. They are exploring different relationships.
Yeah.
Like your real dad, your bio dad, new love.
Yeah, new love, old love.
Like literal old love with Mary Milford. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. There are variations on relations in this episode.
I really wish we could interview this mysterious German who came up with these titles just to get their thought process. I would love to know. But let's get into the episode. It opens on Owl Cave, where Coop, Harry, Andy, and Hawk are just walking in. They don't need spelunking equipment, apparently. That was just a goof by Hawk, I think, on them the first time. They get to the petroglyph spot and find that it's now a huge map. Well, we don't know it's a map yet, but it's a real big image.
Yeah.
And then Coop tells Andy that he needs a large-scale rendering of it. It's a mystery how he gets all that back to the station because he doesn't take a picture.
It's not. I'll just memorize it and go, but yeah.
That's kind of amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, he did draw that amazing portrait of Bob based on Sarah Palmer's description, so I guess he's kind of a savant for drawing stuff.
Andy has some talents that aren't always so apparent.
Yes. Like knowing there's more than one kind of wine.
Right. Oh, he knows all the kinds of wine.
So they note that there's a pair of figures, one giant and one very tiny, standing next to each other. And Hawk notices a boot print that he says matches the one he found outside the power station.
We should have left foot breaking the heel. Win them all.
A little confused because he's just like describing the footprint and then Coop's like, it's Wind of Earl, and I'm like, why does he know his footprint? But then I realize it's the same as the other one, right?
Mm-hmm. Coop also very good at remembering details, apparently, like that he favors his left foot. And then Coop tells Harry to get Briggs to the station. And then he looks genuinely troubled as he stares at the drawing, trying to make out what it all says.
Yeah.
Not often we get that look from Coop.
Yeah, he's pretty rattled. Just like the idea of Wyndham Earl, like, really freaks him out regularly, you know?
Yeah, understandably so. Mm-hmm. And then we get the first of many dissolves in this episode. This is just such a dissolve-heavy episode. That's a Jonathan Sanger style, apparently. To Wyndham at his creepy cabin. And then another directing style I've noticed is start on a close-up, extreme close-up, and then slowly panning out, or zooming out.
Yeah, there was a lot of that.
Yeah. And in this case, they zoom out of his face, Wyndham's face, and then pan over to a bunch of machinery. That's a nice little Lynchian trope there, and we see a rapt Leo listening to the story, and then it lands on a moronic blinking biker.
Right.
His name is Rusty Tomosky.
Yeah, sure. Of course it is.
Played by Ted Raimi. Good old Ted Raimi. Sam Raimi's brother.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. If you are familiar with the television work of Sam Raimi, you would know Ted Raimi because he's in... I mean, he's in a lot of Sam Raimi movies, too, as just bit parts, but he has, like, recurring roles on Xena and... what's the other one? Hercules.
Did not know those were Sam Raimi shows.
Yeah.
I got mixed up because isn't there some other drifter that Wyndham Earl kills that's really Kyle MacLachlan's brother? That's who I was thinking this guy was.
Yes, that's, his last name is the same as Caroline's last name.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Eric Powell. So he sought out that guy because of his last name. But this guy, he just happened to find.
Okay, so here's my issue here. Like, you promised beer, man.
Hey, man. The story's cool. But you promised me beer. You told me it was going to be a party. I mean, White Lodge? Black Lodge? I mean, what's the big deal?
I feel like it would take more than a promise of beer for this old guy to, like, convince this guy to come back to his cabin, you know?
When you hear it described in the next episode from his friend, he's like, we had car trouble, he came out of the woods and said he would help us and give us beer. It's like, that is so sus, guys.
Right.
Get some fucking alarm bells.
Right. This is like a grown adult guy, you know, like a teenager or something, you know? He could get beer, you know? I found it hard to believe that he really lured this guy to his cabin with the promise of beer and a party. I'm sitting at this weird school desk.
I know.
Story for a little bit.
Another interesting prop in that cabin. Just he just like collects garbage, brings it there.
Oh my God. Window.
So busy. They're really establishing that this guy is dumb.
Yeah, he's
very
dumb.
Yeah. That's the only way he would be able to get someone in this position. To be able to construct an entire papier-mâché pawn around you without you really asking questions until it's too late.
Yeah, it's also funny, all of that trouble of, like, the luring. You don't just try and, like, overpower someone and kill him and stick him in this thing, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Is it that important that he's alive while you build the paper mache thing around him?
I think he just wants someone else to monologue at. It's like, Leo hasn't been very fulfilling in that capacity.
So. Leo doesn't really appreciate him in the way he wants to be.
Yeah.
I honestly feel like a motif of this one is men being so extra.
I think so, yes. Good Lord. We always expect that from Wyndham, but he's giving, like, real important information, but because of his super pretentious flowery delivery, I tune out. It's
so
important
hard
shit.
To pay attention to him.
He's telling us about the Black Lodge and the White Lodge, which are, like, the most important fucking things in this world.
Right. And I'm like, okay, you said there'd be beer. Yeah. I don't even drink beer.
All of us are Rusty Tomasky in this case. Right. Like, I'm gonna need something to listen to this. So I actually define the monologue because every time I can't pay attention.
Once upon a time, there was a place of great goodness called the White Lodge. Gentle fawns gambled there amidst happy, laughing spirits.
Something about his voice, I'm like, I cannot listen to you.
For there's another place, its opposite. A place of almost unimaginable power, chock full of dark forces and vicious secrets. No prayers dare enter this frightful maw.
But it's basically, like, kind of Hellraiser-y, the way he's describing it. They're as likely to rip the muscle from our bones as greet you with a happy g'day. If harnessed, these spirits, blah blah blah, will offer up a power so vast that its bearer might reorder the earth itself to its liking.
Wow.
Which is a very significant line, which is why I had to go. I was like, I know he said something important in there. because that is what Judy does.
Oh, right.
If you're able to harness it.
What year is this?
And as we know, when Wyndham Earl shows up, he's like, I'm here to harness the power. And they're like, whatever, dude. I'm ripping your soul out as we speak. You are not worthy of this. Which is kind of fun. That's really interesting that that was set up all the way back here. And then he plays the flute, of course. He just wants an audience so bad that he has to kidnap people to listen to his bullshit.
Right. Not just kidnap, but then, like, keep him in a shock collar.
Oh, yeah. I know, the fact that Leo exists doesn't raise any alarm bells for Rusty either. Like, wait a second. This guy seems like he's here not under his own will. Yeah. I know they say, like, he didn't have a good relationship with his parents, but, yeah, they, like, skipped all of that, the stranger danger lesson.
Great.
And then the camera shows that Earl already has, somehow he has the picture of the petroglyph on his computer.
Right.
It doesn't seem like a photograph. I don't know.
No, it's like he had some, like, early graphic image thing.
It's mysterious technology.
Yeah.
But basically, Coop is not ahead of the game on this one. He is way behind.
Yeah.
And then we dissolve to the Blue Pine Lodge, where Pete is composing a poem to Josie.
I think that I shall never see a girl as lovely as Josie. When she walks into a room, the flowers all stood up to roam down.
He's really missing her.
I know.
Nice. They did have a nice relationship. He was probably, like, the only person that I ever enjoyed Josie's scenes with, you know?
Yes. Because she clearly loved him and didn't need anything from him.
He had, like, a little bit more of a genuine thing than she had with anyone else.
Yeah. Kind of how later on when Catherine's talking about...
Catherine was so insightful.
Yeah. But, like, I do think that she did show, maybe not her true self to Pete, but she was definitely not, she didn't have an agenda.
Yes,
that's the only
exactly.
time she was.
Yeah.
So that's nice for them. Right. And certainly Catherine doesn't treat Pete that way. Catherine only talks to Pete when she needs something. So she needs something right now. She comes in with the puzzle box.
Oh, Josie.
Oh, stop your obsessive
mulching.
Give me a hand with this damn box.
I love this scene. I love these two actors so much.
So funny.
It's the puzzle box that Eckhart left for Jones to give to her, and she's been trying for days to open it. Pete says,
well, let's have a look-see. Do you have a key?
If I had a key, it would be open, don't you think?
Very helpful. Do you have a key? That is, like,
That's a little mansplaining.
I just also feel like everybody has someone, or has, maybe I'm projecting. I have had more than one person I can think of who gives like the least helpful help, you know? Yeah. Like, obviously you would have thought of that.
Yeah.
You know. Oh my God, and I just thought of a third person. Like, way back, like in a bookstore that I worked at. Like, if I couldn't find something, and this guy would be like, did you check this section? Like, did you check where it goes? You know? No, I came to you first, right?
Right. Because I just love the way you treat me when I need to ask you a question.
Or like, someone else I used to know, it'd be like, if you couldn't find something, where's the last place you had it? Like, okay, I don't know. Like,
You don't think I already tried to
read? Like, at step zero, you know?
Right. No, like, we certainly don't.
I've been trying to open this for days.
Yeah.
I'm trying to open it without the key that I have, you know?
Yeah.
But it's so funny, like, his delivery and her reaction.
But he does apologize, which I appreciate. Pete's not trying to be a dick. He just...
Right.
He's preoccupied right now.
I feel like some people can't, like, skip a step, you know? Like, I think it's just how some people's brains work or something, where they don't make that leap of, okay, you want to open this thing, but you obviously would have tried these things before you asked someone for help, you know? And it's just like, oh, let's try to open a KK first. Let's try, you know.
Yeah, I do think that's a good indication of that being his personality as well, when he says that it could take years by design, because it's like, there's a protocol,
right. And
we have to follow it, but then they end up not following it, and that's how you get the box open. But
just throw it on the floor. That's what it turns out.
I do really love that this puzzle box, there's only one puzzle they actually solved to open anything, and the rest of it is smashing, which is really funny. I love he goes on a little digression about the Doolittle twins.
Oh my God, right.
I saw one of these at a crafts emporium on Guam. I was there taking a little R&R with the Doolittle twins. There was a monkey show you wouldn't believe, and Dale Doolittle, now he was the larger of the two. Come to think of it, for twins, they weren't all that much
alike. Peter!
I was so confused by that, but then I came back around, because when he said the Doolittle twins, I was thinking, like, women.
Yeah.
But then he was describing, okay. So I was like, was this, like, in the military in some way? That's
Yeah, he said something about Guam, so I think he was
Guam.
In the
military.
Yeah.
I assumed military, and then
But he said monkey show, which I feel like isn't that sort of like a euphemism, burlesque type thing? Or I don't know. I don't know what a monkey show is, but, or maybe it's a literal show with monkeys.
Maybe.
But anyway, Catherine's not amused.
Always.
Yeah.
He's like dripping gold on her all the time, and it's so wasted.
That's the saddest thing about their relationship, honestly. So then we cut to the double R, where poor Shelley.
I've been doing a lot of thinking about the future and what it takes to get ahead in the world.
From the first second, you can tell Bobby's been a pain in the ass. So. Her posture, she's all slumped over in a booth while he's talking at her.
Suddenly it hits me. Boom. The secret to success. Beautiful people get everything they want.
Bobby.
Yeah, think about it. When's the last time you saw a beautiful blonde go to the electric chair?
This is not our favorite Bobby.
No, although I do think it's very funny, the, like, beautiful people's conspiracy.
I know.
I think it's time we took advantage of this beautiful people's conspiracy.
That's a funny way to say
it. It is, and then also, like, I really feel, just when you think about where Shelley's life goes and how he's like, beautiful people get whatever they want, you're just like, clearly that's not fucking
right,
true.
I know. Battered woman waitress here.
Yeah. He's really
walking the park for the pretty girls.
He's really lucky.
Here's
she doesn't slap him.
Who, like, tried to kill herself, you know?
Yeah.
Also beautiful. Like, the other, my beautiful boss, who's been pining away for a married loser for 20 years.
Oh my God, I know. This
Bobby,
town of Twin Peaks.
Like, who are the beautiful people that, like, are getting anything?
Laura Palmer, for instance.
Right?
Like, you should have learned something from that, I would think. This
I mean,
is not
it's
the best
because Bobby. There is a lot of truth to it, of course. The world is much nicer to beautiful people, but in his actual world, there's like a real abundance of gorgeous women.
Mm-hmm. And each one's more tragic than
like
the last.
Schrodinger's beautiful woman conspiracy or something.
Yes. And I don't like the way he's talking to her.
No.
He says, Bobby's in charge. Ugh, yuck.
Not like that.
Dream on, Bobby. I have tables to wait on.
Shut up. Listen, don't argue with me. Bobby's in charge, you understand? We have to miss this afternoon.
But it also is funny when he says the sky's the limit. Like, when he was
of the scholarship to one specific college.
Right. Sky's the limit.
Yeah.
It's 20.
Think smaller, Bobby.
Right. The ceiling is the limit, I would say.
Yes. The glass ceiling. A curious choice of words, I think, where he says, you have to enlist by this afternoon.
Yeah, that's weird.
He's, like, really thinking of this as service. Meanwhile, in a booth by the window, Dwayne, Milford, and Lana are having breakfast, and she's trying to talk him into fixing the contest for her.
Right. I mean, she took it too seriously, the sky's the limit thing. Like,
yeah. I know, why is it everyone's got their...
so important.
Yeah, because, like, the former winner, Norma, I mean, she does own a diner, but it's
right.
struggling. It's a struggling diner.
Right.
She's not a great success story for the Miss Twin Peaks.
Yeah, what does Lana want out of this?
Yeah.
She's already married to a rich guy.
Yes.
And win the Miss Twin Peaks contest.
You just name it.
I want to win the Miss Twin Peaks contest.
It's interesting. She really is into it, though.
I want this, like... college scholarship? Is she gonna go?
Or just the title, I guess.
Yes, yeah.
The prestigious title.
It's the validation, I guess.
That she is the most beautiful.
Yeah, she does really want that.
There is stiff competition in that regard.
Yeah, I don't think she is. I think at least Shelley and Audrey are, like, definitively, like, no question.
Oh my god, absolutely. Oh, so pretty. Cooper enters exuberantly.
Good morning, Annie.
Hi.
Who's so boyish.
He is.
Schoolgirl, this one.
Yes. Floating on his little toes.
Tingling.
He puts in an order for him and the lawman.
I've got four hungry lawmen out in the police cruiser. We need donuts and coffee. Hot. Two black, two white. No sugars, please.
Mm-hmm. We talked about this a little off pod, how this is, like, a really good way to go for the donuts, because on the DVD menu, we're reminded about when we first met these guys in the donuts. And Lucy was just wasting hundreds of donuts.
The night before.
The night before. So this is a better way to go. I'm glad Coop is turning them around on that.
Yeah,
why don't we just get a dozen donuts in the morning, fresh donuts. We can get more if we need them. Let's just start with 12.
Right.
Between four or five.
People,
yeah.
Right? He says four hungry lawmen.
He does, yeah. And they get the coffees, two white, two black, no sugar. And then he invites Annie to go on a nature study with him. I feel like Heather Graham does a much better job in this episode overall.
I mean, I still don't like her acting at all.
Fair. But I think she does better, especially with this, because she says nature study, sure. Like, she doesn't even think about it. It's like he could have said anything.
I'd like to take this opportunity to ask you if you'd like to accompany me on a nature study this afternoon.
Nature study? Sure.
She was already ready to accept any offer of hanging out with him. He's very happy.
How wonderful.
They're cute how they're so infatuated with each other, but, like, I just find her so off-putting in this. I usually like her, and it was just...
It's a very nuanced character, the way it's written. So it's tough, I think, to wrap your skills around that if you're known for being a beautiful actress.
Well, I think also maybe part of it is that Coop is so, so infatuated with her and finds her irresistible when he very easily resisted Audrey.
Yeah.
And, like, I know part of that is because Audrey was so young, but Heather Graham looks so young. So it's a lot to just get your head around. But I find her having, like, no charisma in this role.
I have to agree. I really want to like her in it, but I just can't. I like that Coop uses kind of the Gordon Cole method of flirting.
When I talk to you, I get a tingling sensation in my toes and in my stomach.
It's interesting.
Don't think it has anything to do with coffee.
I'll get those donuts.
Okay.
Yeah.
Then you find out how much you like someone. Because if you're not into someone, you're like, you're telling your friends about this. So then he was like, I have a tingling sensation in my toes.
Yeah.
Rich.
Totally. The soup of the day is hearty beaver broth, which I really like that. I didn't notice it until the last watch and was like, whoa, okay. Who's ordering that?
That's good. I hope some prop guy's excited that you noticed it.
I hope so too. Whoever wrote that on the board.
It's a random thing like every episode.
Yeah. I try to notice.
Yeah, their specials are pretty rare.
Annie goes to get the donuts and the coffee, and Shelley comes to ring him up, and Bobby exits, and he compliments her in the worst possible way.
Shelley, you are beautiful. Got it?
Use it to your advantage.
Got it.
Jesus. So Shelley mumbles the last line of the poem.
What is all the sweet work worth if thou kiss not me?
In response to Bobby, and Cooper hears her, and oh god, alarm bell's going off.
I beg your pardon?
Oh, it was an anonymous poem someone sent me.
Shelley, I need to see this poem immediately.
Boom, boom. Yeah. The spell is broken.
That's true. And then the spooky music comes in.
Yeah.
And it's really funny the way she says it's just an anonymous poem someone sent me.
It's just an anonymous poem someone sent.
You know, you know, you get anonymous poems all the time.
You know, in a town where a girl was brutally, mysteriously murdered, like, what, 2 weeks ago? It has still not been very long, right?
No, not that long. Maybe like a month, I think.
At the most.
Yeah. Very fresh. Very, right. Very fresh. So he says he needs to see the poem immediately. He gets her third of it. And pockets it, and then Annie comes back, and the happy music comes back in.
A dozen donuts, 4 cups of coffee, 2 black, 2 white, no sugar.
Thank you.
Agent Cooper?
Yes.
This afternoon?
I'll meet you right here. 4 o'clock sharp.
There's some spooky shit going on there.
Yeah, this episode's not very scary, but that part is pretty kind of spooky. Yeah, all of that.
He's so enraptured with Annie, and he's trying really hard to enjoy that, but this pesky Wyndham Earl business keeps popping in. At the police station, he's back in Truman's office with the donuts. I like that the box says donuts, donuts, but it's clearly like the Dunkin' Donuts fonts. And Coop fills Truman in on the poem.
Torn into thirds, sent to Shelley Johnson, Audrey Horn, and Donna Hayward from Wyndham Earl.
He's got it memorized because...
See the mountains kiss high heaven, and the waves clasp one another. No sister flower would be forgiven if it disdained its brother. Poem I once sent to Caroline.
Which I'd completely forgotten when we talked about it before. Once again, just the details. It's the details Wyndham Earl likes.
Wyndham.
And then Hawk shows up with Donna's piece of the poem and says that Audrey's out of town with hers, which is funny because it's like, right. How do you know she took it with her? But right. She just can't give it to them.
Right. Yeah, it could be more like, I don't know where it is.
But. Yeah.
She's in Seattle, who knows?
She sure is,
who knows
for the
how
day.
How far away that is. Like, it seems to change sometimes how far away Seattle is from Twin Peaks, so.
Yeah, because later Ben specifically says she's in Seattle for the day, but she actually did go overnight. That was part of the deal, so.
Yeah.
I don't know. And so then Coop asks Hawk to bring him Leo's arrest record because he recognizes the handwriting.
So I have several questions about that. Well, it's funny that Coop recognizes Leo's handwriting, but Shelley doesn't.
Yeah.
Also, how much of Leo's handwriting is on his arrest record and arrest report, you know?
Well, later they show when he's comparing the two, the notes, you could see like one or two lines from a confession.
I feel like all the lines that we saw on the close-up were just from the poem.
There's definitely a couple lines from a confession of some kind.
Okay, he's talking. I did not see that.
Editor's note: Leo has been arrested several times, though never formally charged. An illegal U-turn, April of 1986. Drunk and disorderly conduct, November 1987. Briefly incarcerated in Hungry Horse, Montana, on February 9th, 1988. Aggravated assault, September of 1988. The charges were dropped. All we can make out on the page Coop is analyzing is, quote, at the depot, and we will, end quote.
I mean, there was
it's a real brief shot.
That I thought was, but then it was more the poem, like the two sister flower or whatever.
I looked for it specifically because of that as well. So then in the conference room, Andy's drawing the large-scale rendering from memory, apparently.
Right.
It's pretty good, except that Major Briggs has one critique.
As I remember, the line you're drawing should proceed downward, not across.
Yeah, so he knows this drawing pretty well.
Yeah, so that's bonkers. I mean, it's really interesting when Andy has these little savant moments.
Right.
And then Coop enters and says they need Briggs' help, but he can't say why, which Briggs is, like, totally down with that vibe.
That tracks for him.
Yeah. They have 3 investigations open.
The disappearance of known felon Leo Johnson, the appearance of my former partner and suspected murderer Wyndham Earl, and the discovery of petroglyphs of an unknown origin in a place called Owl Cave. Now, it would seem logic would dictate that these investigations be considered separate entities. However, I believe otherwise.
Well, he's right about that.
He is. He's still a good detective. Just Windermere knows exactly how to fuck with him. Right. It's not great. So he wants to know from Briggs everything about Earl's time with Project Blue Book. And Briggs is a little bit reticent at first because he's got that loyalty, that pesky loyalty.
The issue is not one of access. However, there are certain moral judgments I must consider.
But then he has, like, a vision, I think, that is sort of Hitchcockian.
Oh, right, yeah.
And that convinces him.
Well, also, it's like not, like, how much of it is he's not allowed to say, or when he says...
My security clearance was revoked shortly after my disappearance.
He says it's a question of morals or something right. like that. Because it's just, like, he made a... Moral considerations. He made a pledge that he would keep the secrets of the... Right. FBI.
Right. But the thing about clearance just makes it seem like he just doesn't have access to information anymore, but...
He says it's not a question of clearance, though.
I know, but why does he mention clearance at all, then?
Because I think he's saying, like, I do know stuff, but I'm not sure if I should tell you.
Yeah, that I got. I still don't see what his clearance really has to do with anything.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe they're just reminding us through dialogue that of where he's standing is, that he's not going to work there every day right now. Right. He does ask,
will this information help you to prevent future loss of life?
Most assuredly.
So yeah, then he has this Hitchcockian vision, which is like the Dugpa silhouette and the petroglyph, and then it kind of cuts to space, and then an owl.
That part's a little weird.
And then some flames. Boom, 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 imagery. But it's all enough to convince him.
I will do what you ask.
So then Hawk brings in Leo's arrest report, and that's when Coop compares the handwriting from Leo's statement about something to the poem, and he says,
gentlemen, the damage to Leo Johnson would alter certain handwriting characteristics. However, the basic style would remain the same.
So he's really good at handwriting analysis, too, apparently.
I feel like it's more vibes than anything. I don't really buy any of that.
Yeah. But he's just, like, so sure. Yeah. Yeah, I can see how if I were Coop and I didn't quite have all the proof that I was really sure of something because of my actual psychic ability.
Right.
Yeah, you could just use your bullshit powers to convince people that you actually know what you're talking about.
Right.
So then at the Great Northern Hotel, it's another close-up of a face. It's Dick Tremaine's face with his bandaged nose from the events of the Weasel Riot. And then it zooms out and he's waiting to see Ben, because he's looking for Audrey. She was supposed to help with the wine tasting benefit, apparently.
Right.
But Audrey's in Seattle for the day, so he tells him to go to the concierge. And then, I don't know, it's interesting, because Ben offers help with his whatever medical bills that he might have in relation to his nose, because it happened on the property. And then Dick's like, sure, yes, and then also...
One might also think workers' compensation in some variety will be involved.
And then Ben's like, shit, I regret offering anything. Because then he immediately escalates.
I'll alert my attorney.
Come on, Dick.
Wow. Don't make a side with Ben.
I know.
Ben has an insane tie and shirt combo going on here.
It's horrible.
A lot of colors and patterns.
I was trying to describe the tie, write it down, what it looked like, and I couldn't even do it. It's red and green with some sort of stripe, and it's, like, leaf-like, but not exactly.
It's really weird.
It seems like it's wider in the middle. And then, yeah, with the red striped shirt. And then I almost feel like it'd be better if the jacket were black. Instead, it's, like, this in-betweeny
bluish-gray.
It's a lot of look.
Yeah.
And so Ben says,
sometimes the urge to do bad is nearly overpowering.
The urge to do bad is overpowering, and then he crunches a carrot.
It's a funny punctuation.
Yeah. That's how he gets himself out of that mode. He's like, okay, I'm going to do something good. He's just got vegetables in his pocket from here on out.
Not in, like, a Ziploc or anything.
No! I know. That's the most troubling part. It's got to have lint all over it.
No.
Fiber, I guess. Fiber from lint?
Fiber in the carrot.
We get a Misty Mountain transition to Wyndham Earl's creepy cabin, where he is going to town on the papier-mâché.
Oh my gosh. This drifter, he did not think to ask questions early enough. He is just now kind of starting to question things.
Yes, after his arms are rendered immobile.
It's in a life-size chest piece.
Yeah, he's almost ready to put the hit on. He's done everything else.
Right.
So but it's gotten
not
so far.
Though, too.
Yeah, but he kills him first.
Really hard. I know, but
just, it's really good work. So I couldn't do that. I could not make something quite so nice. I wouldn't try, probably,
no way.
But...
That's a dodeca challenge. Make the best life-size paper mache.
Chess piece. At least he picks pawn, which is probably the easiest one to do if you're going to do any chess piece.
I feel like rook would probably be easier.
That's not the horse, is it?
No, that's knight.
Knight, okay.
Rook is like a little castle. The top, like, it's more... It's edge. It's not, like, rounded.
Okay.
I feel like that would be the easiest one.
But he probably picks pawn because symbolism.
Oh, I thought he picked pawn because it was the chess move or something.
He doesn't actually assign a chess move to it, though. Mm. It's just a pawn, and then it says, next time it'll be someone you know.
Wow.
It's the next episode where he literally, like, knocks all the pieces off the board. Game. Yeah. So this is kind of his way of being like, I'm done playing this game.
Yeah.
It's my final move. He's doing the papier-mâché. He's opening a beer. Finally, the promised beer.
Yeah.
He gets, like, one sip of beer.
We celebrate. Celebrate, I can barely move my arms.
Before he asks Leo to fetch him his arrow.
This is the thing, too. It's like he really dies on this hill of, like, Leo has to fetch the arrow. And I feel like he's worked so hard. Like, he does so much. And
yeah.
Then he's like, but I won't pick up an arrow myself, you know?
Leo, the arrow.
No.
Is that the gate? I'm supposed to get my beer without it, you know.
That hurts.
Fetch me the arrow.
Just because they're across the room.
Right. Well, I feel like also it's that he wants Leo to be an accomplice to this murder, you know?
Mm.
I feel like Leo wouldn't care about helping build the stupid paper machine.
Yeah.
Hey, is this for, like, the lilac parade or what?
not a parade, my friend. Not exactly.
It is very hilarious the way the second the arrow gets... Like, how is he dead from this one arrow through the papier-mâché somewhere in the chest and, like, instantly blood on the mouth and dead?
Yeah,
like,
that's a quick cut.
I feel like Windermere looked it up in, like, some medical textbook of, like, what's a spot that an arrow would kill you instantly.
Yeah.
Because I assume you could take an arrow, a little arrow, too. It's not even that big.
Like, yeah.
Through papier-mâché. Right.
So he has to know.
Or in the gut or in the arm. You could survive that, right?
Definitely.
And this guy is, like, instantly dead.
Yeah.
Blood out the mouth.
Yes.
The face.
It seems like the neck would have been the thing to go for, and that's sticking out the top.
I was expecting, like, the head.
Yeah.
The neck. Yes, that's sticking out the top.
I would assume there's two reasons why they did it that way, but it's not smooth at all. One is, like, sensors.
Yeah.
It can't be too violent. They couldn't have him, like, writhing around or gushing blood from anywhere. And two, just time. Like, we don't have time to watch a guy die.
Right.
We have to be like, okay, bam, he's dead. But it could have been done smoother in the edit somehow. Because it really just seems like the very next second
right.
he's dead.
Yeah.
Oh, and of course, before he dies, he has to listen to one more monologue from Windermere.
Think of all the hapless sinners wondering where their soul's destination lies.
For what?
To gain the answer to a simple question. Where will my spirit awake? What life am I given after this life?
God, what a terrible last thing to hear before you die.
Absolutely. I do think that a motif of the episode is heaven and hell, because people are talking about it a lot.
Yeah.
They'll just compare things to heaven or hell, and then in this particular scene, he's literally saying, like, you're going to the afterlife right now, so congratulations.
Right.
Where will my spirit awake?
You lucky boy! You have the answer.
Then we cut to the roadhouse.
Miss Twin Peaks, judging and rules committee is now in session.
Made up of Doc Hayward, Mayor Milford, and Pete.
What a strange committee.
It's an interesting one.
Right.
These are the ones who wanted to do it? I don't know.
Yes. I mean, especially Doc Hayward.
Well, Doc Hayward just wants to be involved in literally everything.
I was going to say, like, does he not have enough on his plate? You know?
I know. Anyway, he and Laura were kind of in competition for who could be the most involved. And then Pete, like, obviously later on, we're like, oh, Pete just likes looking at pretty ladies because he is so excited about that.
Right. And Pete also doesn't have so much to do.
He's not that busy.
Right.
He wants projects. And then Milford, he's got some funny deliveries in this episode. He says this year is going to be very exciting. He says that twice.
You know, this year is going to be very exciting.
That way.
Very exciting. This year is going to be very, very exciting.
Thank you, Dwayne.
He just really has got that Muppet energy.
Yeah.
And then Ben Horn wants to address the committee and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, that's blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
That's right.
I like that even though Mary Wilford is basically senile, he's like,
what's he selling? What are you selling?
I can tell that this is bullshit, even though I don't know why.
Right. It's like, we're barely following the storyline anymore, but we can tell. Sus.
Yeah. He makes a good argument.
The topic of this year's speeches should be how to save our forests. It's now. It's relevant. It's global, and it's, well, to put it plainly, gentlemen, it's us.
Good thing for the wrong reasons.
Right, exactly.
And I love that Pete is like,
of course, your opposition to the Ghostwood development plans wouldn't have anything to do with this.
Or could it be that you,
right,
you yourself want to stop Ghostwood?
A fun coincidence.
Yeah.
Pete. I resent your invitation.
And what he really means is, yes, that's absolutely correct.
More fast. The idea has merit. The idea has merit.
And then on his way out, he steps by a table where Bobby is sitting.
Bobby.
Hey, Chief.
Don't forget the dry cleaning, all right?
Thanks.
It's a bullshit excuse to talk to Bobby because Donna's at the table.
Right.
Because then he gives Donna a lingering look, and she's got misty eyes already. I think that's really interesting, where the camera does a close-up on her face. Her eyes are all misty. I don't know if that's Laura Flynn Boyle acting or the old eye drops trick, but it was notable to me.
Yeah, there's stuff going on with her.
And then the pageant registration begins, and Lana comes up, and Bobby's like,
Does anybody smell a fix?
The fix is in.
Right.
Yeah.
A lot of people being right.
Yeah. Calling shit out.
Yeah.
And Shelly's all nervous, which is so cute.
I can't do this, Bobby. I have never made a speech before in my life. I read a book report in the fourth grade in front of Mrs. Gardner's class, and I passed out right in front of the whole room.
Yeah, she's so nervous, like, giving a speech.
Yeah.
Did she really faint in fourth grade? I don't know. That seems...
Maybe. I don't know. It is a lot. That would be a lot. But it's like some people really have terrible stage fright.
Yeah.
And then Nadine and Mike walk in, which is awesome.
Yes.
Nadine also loves to be involved. Maybe Emoji if it's just like civic involvement.
Right.
She says, I wouldn't miss it for the world.
Of course not.
Donna, are you majoring too? You too?
Oh, I wouldn't miss it for the world.
Isn't it exciting?
And then Bobby's like, hey, I haven't seen Mike in a while. I'm going to check in with this guy. And what an interesting conversation they have.
This is very scary, Mike. It's not what you think.
It's not what I think. What do you think I think?
You think I'm going out with an older woman?
I think I don't know where you got this sudden interest in the life of fossils.
Yeah, but it's not what you think. Do you have any idea what a combination of sexual maturity and superhuman strength can result in?
What could Mike have said so succinctly?
Yes, very short.
Really conveyed some information. I feel like you can interpret a lot from the stuff that you hear him say. You know?
Yeah.
Sexual maturity, superhuman strength. I don't know.
Okay, use your imagination.
Exactly. And then it's like, he says some very specific thing.
Yeah.
What he said. What's he doing?
I know. And it makes Bobby have to play pinball all of a sudden. Yeah, it's really, Bobby, he spins around and starts going to town on the pinball machine, which is very funny. God, Dana Ashbrook. We haven't gotten a lot of extra Dana Ashbrook acting in a while, and it's just wonderful to see.
It's so good. I really like Mike's arc, you know?
I know.
He's not, like, embarrassed at all to be Dana.
Yeah, because he's like, dude, it's awesome. I mean, you're an idiot if you don't see that. Or it's like, nothing to me if you don't. It's just, right, I'm having a great time.
It's like, I don't even care.
And then we dissolve to the map, and briefly Wyndham's face, I don't know why. And, what's wrong with the good old spooky tree transition? I guess we're just being reminded that the main theme of the episode is the map. And then we're at the Blue Pine Lodge, where Truman has come looking for answers about Josie.
Yeah, he's so damn bad, that guy.
He really needs to understand. And Catherine has really been thinking about it a lot.
Yeah.
Well, I think that early in her life, she must have learned the lesson that she could survive by being with other people wanted to see, by showing them that. And whatever was left of her private self, she may never have shown to anyone.
So all the stories, the lies were...
Well, who knows? They may not have seemed untrue to her.
Very insightful theory, I thought.
Yes. Clearly she's worked it up. I don't think that was off the cuff. She spent a lot of time thinking about it, too. That she learned to survive by being a chameleon. And I like that line, whatever was left of her private self, she may have never shown to anyone.
In spite of all the things she tried to do to me and my family, I find it curiously hard to hate her for it.
And I think that's the closest she's going to come to being, like, nice to Truman, you know? Like,
yeah.
With Pete, it's like, oh, stop moping, get over it.
Yeah.
So at least, you know, she's trying a little bit.
I can see that too. Or like Pete, you know, Pete's her husband, so she's like, I can't hear this all the time, but this guy's really grieving.
Right. So I'm gonna try and tell you, like, you're not grieving something real. Nobody really knew her. Like, she didn't show her real self to you.
Yeah. That is kind. That's very kind. And then they bring out the puzzle box to talk about, and then Pete is at that moment returns home with this funny exclamations.
Wowee, Bob, have we got some beauties in the contest this year. Hello, Harry.
And then, in attempting to help, he accidentally drops the box.
Yes, butterfingers.
Say, have you had any luck with this thing? Oh, butterfingers.
Favorite line.
So great. But it opens the box. It fucking works.
Yes. I don't like that. I hate that no one, like, actually figures it out.
I think it's pretty funny, actually.
It's funny, but I also don't like it. I want the satisfaction of it being figured out.
Well, there is one puzzle they solve later, at least. On those fake buttons that are obviously not really pressing anything. It's funny. So, yeah, it opens it, and then inside is another box with, well, it's moon phases in a clock formation.
Yeah.
With symbols next to each one.
Right.
Are they, like, astrological signs?
That's what I thought, like...
So that's how you know the date?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know all the astrological symbols.
Yeah, I feel like I definitely saw the one for Gemini in there.
Is it the 69 one? Yeah. Yeah. And then he tries to drop it again to see if that opens it, but it doesn't. And Catherine is very annoyed about that.
Yeah. I mean, fair.
And then she hands it to Harry for some reason. I don't know how he's going to help. But it does facilitate a really good dissolve. My favorite, perhaps, dissolve in the episode. Through the moon phase clock to Coop and Annie in a boat.
Yeah.
At Easter Park. And they're having a very romantic time on a rowboat.
I used to swim here every summer. 2 or 3 times a week.
And I made a good choice. It's beautiful.
And then they start talking about their past. Coop asks questions.
Any boyfriends?
No.
Really?
Well, I had one.
High school?
Senior year.
Have anything to do with why you went into the convent?
I'm sorry, do you mind if we don't talk about it?
Not at all. We can talk about whatever you'd like.
It's a good conversation.
Yeah.
Shot in very tight close-ups of the two of them. Which I guess it would have to be in a boat.
It's a nice, like, genuine, like, two people getting to know each other, kind of, you know, getting more comfortable with each other. She's like, I don't want to talk about it. And coming out. And it's really nice. He's, like, so much more easy in this scene when he's not all, like, stiff and goofy.
Yeah, that's true.
And he's like, we can think about whatever you want. I love that.
Yeah. He's kind of in his element, romancing-wise. He's already done the work of getting him to this sweet boat situation. Right. So, it's, I mean, it's less of a question of, does she like me? It's like, obviously she does, because she agreed to go into a little boat with me in the middle of the lake.
Right.
nature study. They're not looking at any of the nature, I gotta tell you. I love the way he kind of touches her scar. It's really, it's just a very sweet romantic scene.
I mean, I know how hopeless things can seem. I know about the dark tunnel you can fall into.
Happened before I went away. Happened because of that boy.
Something similar happened to me. Made me want to disappear from the world. Because of that, maybe I can help.
And then she kind of is like, well, I don't know how to trust people, but I'm trying to trust. And they kiss. It's a very sweet kiss.
Yeah, very romantic setting for their first kiss.
Yeah. But unfortunately, as they come ashore, the music turns sinister.
And Windham.
The music is definitely doing a lot of heavy lifting because it shows Windham in the most ridiculous outfit yet, I think.
No, it's like no reason for this. Unnecessary.
He's more extra than any fisher. He looks like he's wearing a fisherman costume, for one thing. Like, if you want to blend in, wear, like, what Pete would wear.
Right. And also, like, nobody knows him. The only one who knows him is Coop. And Coop would know him by seeing him.
Yeah.
He's in a fisherman outfit. Like, what is any of this for?
I know, he doesn't even have his fake beards on.
He just really likes that.
He's like, I rented the costume, I'm going to wear it.
I brought so much stuff with me to Twin Peaks. How did he get there? He had so much stuff with him. Where did he come from?
I know. I imagine him traveling by boat like Dracula with just crates of things.
I have, like, logistic questions about him.
It's a very great question.
This was before the days of, like, you could just order things 24 hours.
Yeah.
And you'd show up.
Amazon is not dropping off a fisherman costume in the morning. Yeah. And the binoculars. Like, do you even need the binoculars? They're not that far from shore.
None of this is necessary. I believe he could have gone in what he was wearing any other time.
Yeah. It's all just drawing attention to him.
Yeah, exactly.
He's just getting sloppy. Maybe it doesn't matter anymore.
Wouldn't be in the park, so I have to be dressed up as a fisherman.
I know. Everyone goes to that park all the time.
Right.
And then we're at the Great Northern, where Dick is hosting his onophiliac soiree. Oh, no, what?
Something to do with wine.
Lana and Lucy are helping, and Andy's there. He knows a thing or two about wine.
There are some schools of thought who, of course, say there are no other wines but reds. Yes, Andy?
There are also white wines and sparkling wines.
Yeah, exactly two things.
And he takes a premature sip, which enrages Dick.
Let us first examine. Don't taste it yet, Andy, for heaven's sake. Spit it out!
Dick's being very extra.
He wants control over everyone's experience of this wine, which is annoying.
That's like the worst, I know.
I would never want to go to one of his wine tastings.
Or any, I know. I took a wine tasting class once and I stopped taking it. I was like, this is the worst.
Ugh, yeah.
I'm like, I taste wine every time.
Right. I know, I almost feel like saying wrong is so fucked up because it's
right.
Like, it's like a Rorschach test.
It tastes kind of woody.
No, not really.
People name, like, 11 things.
And every time the sommelier is like,
good,
correct,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, you get that shoe leather? Yes, yeah. That's intentional.
Also, the thing he says no to is woody, which is like, is the wine like always in a barrel?
Yeah.
Right? So it's like,
she probably is
like,
right.
Woody is like always something. It's like saying you taste grape. You know, like there's going to be some element
to
that.
So that's correct. That's more correct than banana.
Banana, right?
Lana?
Banana?
Yes. There is a hint of banana. That's the metachloric acid. Very good.
He's being shitty just to Lucy, so she's very warranted later with her marvelous, marvelous spitting. But first, we have Dick taking his first sip, and if you've wondered why he's been wearing that white bandage this whole time on his nose, it's so that when he dips his face in to take in the bouquet, he can get something on his face. Classic
right.
Dick Tremaine.
Classic, I know.
What a buffoon. And then at the Double R, Gordon Cole is sitting in a booth with Shelley. God, this is just one of my favorite scenes in all of Twin Peaks. So fucking phenomenal. Telling his war stories.
So he came slowly out of the shadows, leaving the dead girl behind. And I said, you take one more step and I will ventilate you.
Ooh.
It was was a brief but touching funeral.
In a conversational tone, because Shelley, he can hear her, she can hear him.
That's also nice that he's just talking normally.
Yeah. However briefly.
Right.
Then Coop and Annie arrive, and he's like, "You remember Annie?" And I love his response.
"Of course I do. This world of Twin Peaks seems to be filled with beautiful women.
Although only one I can hear."
Only one I can hear.
I love no. That. Yeah. Swoon. I really love Shelley's outfit in this scene, too. It's like, oh, it's 90s, but it worked for me. I don't know.
So fussy. I don't.
No.
Okay. I don't ever like a top like that.
The sheer top?
No, it's like all sleeves and ruffles. Is it the same outfit she had on earlier? Is
that, yes.
It has like ruffles or puffy stuff.
It does have ruffles.
It has a lot. No.
It doesn't look comfortable, but I think it looks good on her.
I mean, she can look good in anything, but I do not like it. At all.
Okay.
I would feel very strongly.
All right. Fair, fair. I mean, maybe it's just because there's a lot of bad sweaters in this episode. Hideous sweaters. I might have said something about Dick Tremaine's sort of Cosby sweater in his scene with Ben, except that Ben was wearing the worst outfit ever.
There's a lot of ugly clothing.
So. Yes.
But sorry, I got to throw Shelley's top in along with that. I don't like it at all.
Okay. So back to Shelley and Cole. Cole's on his way out of town.
He doesn't know when he'll return.
I know. He asks Annie and Coop to join him.
"Join us for pie! Love to! 3 each!
3 each.
It's good pie. And while they have the pie...
"Shelley, turn around and face me a moment before I lose my nerve. I'm about ready to leave Twin Peaks, and I don't know when I'm going to return. But I want you to know that meeting you has been more than a privilege. It's touched my heart. And I know that if I don't kiss you now, I'm going to regret it the rest of my days."
So cute.
Yeah.
And she is very into it. And just then Bobby walks in.
Hey!
Hey.
The jukebox. Yeah. Scratch. It's been going this whole time with the diner ditty.
Right.
I don't know if he bumps it on his way in or what happens. It's very funny, though. Very noticeable.
What the hell's going on?
Gordon's never seen this guy before in his life.
Right.
So he says the best line ever.
"You are witnessing a front three-quarter view of two adults sharing a tender moment."
Acts like he's never seen a kiss before.
"Take another look, Sonny. It's going to happen again."
And it does. And Shelley's all about it. She's so annoyed with Bobby. This is like the perfect... I love this for her. I love this journey. Sweet, sweet Gordon Cole. And then we're back at the wine tasting, and that's when Lucy tastes wood, and Dick is like, "No, you don't."
Oh, God.
"What else?"
"Banana."
"Chocolate. Correct, Andy."
I really like Lucy's response.
"Why don't we just skip the wine and have a banana split?"
I think
that's pretty funny, yeah.
It's very funny.
I would rather have that than this dumb wine tasting.
Absolutely, me too. That's when he says, "What's your reaction, Lucy?" And then she does the long spit right in his face.
"I'm pregnant. I'm not supposed to drink."
She gets some real projection on that.
Yes, fantastic. Yeah. And then in the lobby of the Great Northern, Coop is sipping a glass of warm milk by the fire, and who should join him but a lovelorn John Justice Wheeler.
"What is hell? Sorry? Love? It's hell."
John Justice Wheeler. This scene is insane.
It is. It doesn't make any sense that these two are having an interaction other than...
They are total strangers.
It's fun.
This is a conversation between total strangers.
Yes. Like, he's staying at this hotel. He's all hung up on this woman. He just needs to talk to somebody about it. So he's like, "Who can I talk to about this?"
Right.
That guy doesn't look busy.
By the fireplace, right?
Yes. Yeah, love is hell.
Really get why for John Justice Wheeler in this moment that love is hell. She's just like not there right now, you know?
Yeah, that's true.
"I got something to learn.
Sounds like you've got a pretty serious case. Broad arm, rope tied, and branded. She feel the same way?"
"There's hope."
She's definitely like already made it clear that she's into him.
Right. This is like they recently met someone and they're into each other. That's not hell.
Yeah. So that says a lot about his personality.
It hates you like an 18-wheeler, doesn't it? There's no relief.
Makes you feel more alive.
Makes you feel more of everything. Pain included. Especially pain.
Oh, that being so extra. I'm, like, not kidding that that's a motif of men being extra.
I think so. He's drinking some bourbon.
He's a total stranger that love is hell.
Totally. I mean, Coop does look very friendly. He's already talked to Ben about this, I guess. Coop says the Hindus say love is a ladder to heaven. Mm-hmm. So heaven and hell. And then they toast to each other.
Toast to you.
And then again, because this is an episode of Bad Outfits, I barely noticed that he's wearing a turtleneck, but he is. Yeah. Ooh, I never like a turtleneck. Almost never. I mean, there might be one or two exceptions in this world, but...
It's like very 70s.
And it's not this man. He's a butt only his face guy.
Butter body?
I'm sure the body under the clothes is good. It's just the clothes are bad. He gets a telegram... I love that he tips the bellman.
Yes.
Solid. But unfortunately, he has some bad news.
Would you kindly tell the front desk that I'll be checking out? Yes, sir.
You gotta go.
He's gotta get out of there. That sucks.
Yeah.
Waterfall transition to dinner at the Hayward house.
Would you pass the peas, Donna?
I love this scene.
Where are the other children?
They're serving enough food for five people, but there are only three present.
Who is it in this household that's so crazy for peas? Because it's so much.
I guess it's Eileen, because she's the one who wants them.
Enormous thing. How's your mother the peas, man? Those are so many peas.
It's a huge bowl of peas. And some sort of meat.
Yeah.
Just so awkward.
Mom, can I ask you something?
Sure.
How do you know Benjamin Horne?
Eileen, I told Donna about the Heal the Planet benefit you're working on.
Donna's tired of this shit.
Yes.
I love this Donna.
I saw him at the house. You drove to see him yesterday? Oh, yes, he's offered to give us some time.
I know he favors several local charities.
Well, that must have been it. One of the local charities must have sent Mom's roses. Would you pass the peas, Donna? I think roses are really romantic, don't you?
Everything she says has such subtext. It's like, what?
She rolls in the scene. And her parents are still trying to deny, deny, deny.
Yeah, as you do. Parenting 101, guys.
It's not just a river in Egypt. Doc is trying to pull that charity work line, and
right.
Donna's like, oh, really? The charity sent roses to Mom? Those are pretty romantic.
That's really funny.
Yeah.
Doc Hayward is like, stop it.
Donna, pass your other peas.
That's when she says that she wants to join the pageant.
I entered. Really? Well, you never seemed very interested before. I guess I just figured I could use the scholarship money to study overseas.
Although I don't think that's how scholarships work, but I appreciate the sentiment of, like, I'm gonna get the fuck out of here because you guys are bullshit.
She's saying, fuck you,
everybody. Which is very fair because where are her sisters?
Right.
These are not good parents.
Tell me where is Gustin?
We get an owl transition to Easter Park, where Coop has been called out to investigate the giant wooden crate that has appeared in the gazebo. Truman thought it might be a bomb, but it's not ticking and there's no metal inside. So Coop devises this very interesting sort of rock and crime tape and gun scenario.
I know, that's funny that he shoots it. It's like,
yeah, when he's setting it up, you're like, what's he going to do with this?
He's going to be like a yank on a rope or something, and then nothing, you actually shoot something. That's pretty...
Yeah, because he said something about, like, there might be shrapnel inside. He says, whatever else hell can imagine. So again, with hell imagery, he knows this guy's fucking shady, so everyone gets behind the cruiser. He shoots the rock perfectly. God, such an amazing shot. Holy shit.
That's a motif. Perfect aim. Oh my god, that is. Perfect aim really is a motif.
Oh, it is.
You see spit take and the arrow and that. That's,
Wow, yeah.
On target.
That's pretty good. I like it. And the box opens to reveal our drifter.
Oh no, Rusty.
Rusty dead. Dead as a doornail.
No.
And it says sign on
neck. Don't follow strangers with promises of beer.
You sure don't. Or parties. I know he's like a party too.
Party.
Where's the party? Next time it will be someone you know.
I know.
That's the end of the episode, by the way. I have been reading Lynch on Lynch, and there were some quotes that I thought of for this episode.
One.
He's talking about as a child, and he visited his grandfather in the city, and he said, "I learned that just beneath the surface there's another world, and still different worlds as you dig deeper. There's goodness in blue skies and flowers, but another force, a wild pain and decay, also accompanies everything."
Ooh.
There's a lot of, like, surface loveliness and digging deep to find the decay.
Two.
He's talking about a painting that he made called I See Myself, and he says, "Our trip through life is to gain divine mind through knowledge and experience of combined opposites. And to reconcile those two opposing things is the trick. The middle isn't a compromise. It's like the power of both."
That's a lot of insight for his stuff.
It really is. And I kind of feel like Coop's biggest problem is that he can't reconcile good and evil in that way. He sees it as too black and white and opposing forces. And that's kind of what leads to his what year is it downfall, I think. Yeah, let's talk about motifs. We've mentioned a couple.
Yeah, the heaven and hell and the perfect aim.
And maybe beauty is a curse, kind of. The opposing thing of Bobby saying, like, beautiful people get everything they want. And then there's a lot of beautiful people talking about their shitty lives.
That's true, yeah. There is, like, no beautiful person that's just, like, killing it.
Yeah, not really.
Right.
Because she's saying how, like, Norma was so popular in high school, and she seemed like she had it together and friends and everything. And it's like, well, that didn't get her very far. Even John Justice Wheeler's got
a... Yeah, he's a very attractive man who is, for some reason, in hell because he met a girl who likes him.
Who met the most beautiful woman in Twin Peaks, right. And she likes him back, and it's hell.
She's just gone for a day.
I mean, I guess I could see that. How, like, oh my god, she's been gone for so long.
It's pretty extra, though.
It is really extra. Editor's note. During the recording of this episode, we neglected to discover a very prevalent motif... The number two, duality, and people saying lines twice. It was particularly noticeable during the Hayward dinner scene when Eileen asks to be passed the peas on two separate occasions.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Roadhouse is proud to welcome...
All right, let's do some awards. Let's go fish in the percolator.
Well, I mean... There's a lot of funny stuff in this one, but for me, it's got to be Butterfingers.
Butterfingers!
Brothers and I have said it for the last 30 years. Butterfingers! This is a funny delivery of, like a dramatic delivery of, like, such a goofy word.
Yeah. And it's an overreaction, kind of, to what happened. Like, it's not a big deal that he dropped this thing. It's not like it shot. You wanted it open. That's what happened. Catherine is the original extra character, and she's still
still
bringing it, even though there's a lot of competition in this episode. I gotta go with Gordon Cole, Take Another Look, Sonny.
Yeah.
I think about that scene all the time, and I think about that line delivery all the time, and it's so funny. But yes, so much competition for...
Yeah, this was a really funny episode.
It's hilarious. Which is why the Ceiling Fan Award is going to be difficult, because I'm not even sure.
Yeah, I have something. I mean, it's not very scary, but it's a little ominous when Coop says what the poem is, you know, when he's like, I sent that poem to Caroline. So it's like, oh, that's kind of scary.
Yeah, that's like fucked up in retrospect. We didn't know this whole time.
And like these three girls who have nothing to do with anything, like getting threatened, essentially.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I guess I have to go along with the poem thing, too, and when the music changes, when he first hears Shelley, because that's the scariest thing for him. I think Coop's scariest moment
is
just when he hears Shelley say that line, and the music echoes that.
Right.
All right, LVP.
This was also, like, a little hard, because I like a lot, but, I mean, actually, no, it's sort of easy, because it was Dick. There's nobody less valuable to me than Dick Tremaine in this episode.
Yeah, that is a good point. Mm-hmm. Let me think if there's anybody worse than him. Like, you could easily cut the wine tasting subplot, yeah. Even though it takes a lot of the episode.
Yeah, it has nothing to do with anything, really.
Yeah. Well, okay, so I was going to go originally with Bobby because I'm just so upset with him.
Right.
But he does have some value because he kind of changes his tune in this episode. He's, like, being so shitty and controlling, And then he sees Gordon kiss Shelley, and it changes his whole perspective on shit. And that's good. So I was going to go with him, but I think I'm going to agree with you on Dick Tremaine. So you got lucky on this one, Bobby. But don't let it happen again. MVP.
This is one I doubt I have ever chosen before. I'm sure I have never chosen this one, but I am going with Catherine.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, because, I mean, every scene she's in, she's great. She said Butterfingers. She had that insight with Truman. So, yeah. I really doubt I have ever. I don't usually even really like her that much. But
yeah. I'm sure I have chosen her before, or maybe Piper Laurie. I can't remember, but yeah. She's a bad lady, so she doesn't come up as MVP very often. But yeah, she is so funny, and Piper Laurie is so good in this episode. And I'm going to go with one I've definitely never picked before, and probably never will again, but this is my chance to pick Donna.
Oh, right.
I'm living for Donna in this episode. I love the dinner scene. I like even earlier when she's just got that misty eye and her look at Ben as he's leaving, and she's just like so pissed off at this whole scenario, and rightly so. It makes me really lament what we didn't get from Donna when she could have been having adventures with Maddie only, or all the times she was just hampered by James.
Donna without James.
Donna without James could soar. She could go off to Europe and have a great time.
Yeah.
So yeah, you did it for me, Donna. I love you in this episode. All right, and next up, we're going to have so many exciting things to talk about.
I know, with so many guest stars, too.
Yeah, it's hot guests for the rest of the season, y'all. So stay tuned. Really Weird Stuff is hosted by Annie Malone and Jessica Baxter. Music by Julie Cruz, Angelo Badalamente, and Jessica Baxter. If you enjoyed Really Weird Stuff, please take a minute to rate and review us on your favorite podcast app. Follow us on Instagram at reallyweirdstuffpod, on Twitter at reallyweirdpod, and on Facebook at reallyweirdstuffpodcast. Thank you for listening.